I'm Nick Harcourt, and welcome to another episode of The Sound of Success, the podcast where we talk with movers, shakers, and just plain cool people about music.
Joining us on this episode of The Sound of Success is accomplished songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, and one of the most highly regarded bass guitar players working today, Gail Ann Dorsey. As a session musician, her work has graced recordings and performances by numerous artists, including The National, Lenny Kravitz, Brian Ferry, Boy George, The, Gwen Stefani, Charlie Watts, Seal, Gang of Four, Tears for Fears, Anna DeFranco, and The Indigo Girls. And she played bass in David Bowie's band from 1995 through his last tour in 2004. Apart from playing bass with Bowie, she sang lead vocals on live versions of Under Pressure, taking the part originally sung by Queen frontman Freddie Mercury, and duetted with Bowie on a whole host of other songs, and contributed bass and or backing vocals on his albums Earthling, Heathen, Reality, and The Next Day. Gail has also released three solo albums, The Corporate World, Rude Blue, and I Used to Be. In December of 2021, Bass Player magazine gave Gail a Lifetime Achievement Award. It's great to catch up with you, Gail. It's been a minute. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, Nick. It's really nice. It's nice to get to chat with you again. It has been a while.
Now, I distinctly remember the first time I met you. It must have been somewhere in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s. It was in Woodstock, New York, and I was driving down a mountain road, Yerry Hill Road, into town.
No.
And you were coming the other way in the passenger seat of some amazing old school convertible driven by our mutual friend and amazing musician, Sarah Lee. And we stopped mid-road, as people do who live in the countryside, and Sarah introduced us. When was that?
That would have been, well, there was the top was down. She had a big old, like, 72 Impala, like a convertible. And I was visiting from London. I hadn't officially moved here yet, or maybe I had just moved here. So that would be 94, summer, or 94, 90, no, summer of 94.
I think it might have been just before the Woodstock 94 festival. I have a
It would have been record, yeah, sometime yeah. That spring or something, but it was a nice day. And
wow.
I was trying to remember myself, and then I was like, I have video of that. I used to film everything in those days. I don't know if you remember, I was always carrying a video camera around.
And I do, and I'm actually...
Over the pads in the car that day of me being introduced to you. I have to go and check. I'm pretty sure you did.
I hope you have that somewhere. I actually want to talk about your love of film, because I know it's a part of your life as well. But before we jump into that, let's go back a little bit. Growing up in the 70s in West Philadelphia, you're a little bit younger than me, but we're sort of in the same age group, right?
I think so. I think that, certainly for like kind of knowing musical things and stuff that were happening at that time. Yeah, it was, well, man, I couldn't think of a better place outside of maybe New York City, but to grow up as a teenager in Philadelphia in the 70s as a youngster, because of music, because I loved music. I loved it since I can remember. I had an interview earlier today for something, and someone asked me something about, you know, when did you know that you wanted to be a musician, or what made you, that was the question, how it was phrased, what made me decide to want to be a musician? And I was like, nothing made me. It was like it was already there. It was like I really knew since I was very, very young, I had to express myself musically. I wasn't sure how, but it was something that I heard when I heard music. And Philly at that time was it still is a great music town. I mean, there was just so much great stuff on the radio. There were so many bands around. It's like it was hopping musically. Philly had its own thing, like Motown, the Philly sound with Gamble and Huff was happening. Tom Bell, all these amazing records they produced, the Stylistics. And it was just all this incredible music around me all the time. So I think it helped me to grow up in Philly. It was a tough time growing up there then because of the racial thing, which is probably still happening, and sadly seems to have come back around for some strange reason. But growing up in West Philly as a kid, I had, I had a lot of issues with, you know, race stuff and being called all kinds of names and chased and bottles thrown and tricks played on me by, you know, white people. And it was horrible. That part of it was horrible. There were very, very definitive turfs. Like literally, if you went above 63rd Street or if you went into the South Philly, like there was all these places you knew you just didn't go if you were black. And it was cut and dry. There was no kind of in between. You know, there were not too many liberals around whenever.
Yeah.
So I heard a lot of stuff like that growing up, especially because music unites people. And I had a lot of white friends or Jewish friends or whatever, because we would meet at a Queen concert or because we would see each other at a musical event, which was always something that I just thought was beautiful about music. It seemed to not have those boundaries. Like there were no boundaries in that, in terms of people enjoying whatever country they came from or whatever color they were. So it was, you know, and even the first bands I played in was, you know, with some white guys or some other, you know, a mixture of people. It wasn't just, you know, that. So the sort of just the day-to-day life was a little tough in terms of, especially for me, because I wanted to go out and explore and be with all kinds of people. So I was always warned, you know, be careful, don't go in that neighborhood. Or, you know, I had some encounters.
Your dad passed away when you were just six, right? So
right.
You grew up with your mom. Any siblings?
Yeah, I have three older brothers and a sister, older sister. I'm the youngest of five. But they were all pretty much out of the house by the time I was, say, 10, 11. So so those formative kind of puberty, whatever, adolescent years was just me and my mother, which to me were a very important years. But because I was the surprise baby, you know, after five kids.
Yeah.
My sister's like 7 years older than me, and then it's 10 years, 12 years, 13 years. So they were all pretty much gone to college. I had a brother in the Marines and a brother in the Air Force, another one in college. My sister was in college. You know, they were out of the house. But they were very important in terms of the music that they brought into the house when I was young. The first music I heard that made me want to, like, just listen to music all day long.
Music was around, obviously, music in the house. And you got your first guitar when you were nine?
Yeah, birthday present.
Did you ask for it?
I had been asking for it since I was 4 years old. I wanted a guitar. And I used to spend a lot of time we lived in one of those Philly row houses, like West Philly row houses. And my next door neighbor was my godmother. Her name was Edith Hamilton. And I spent a lot of time in Edith's house, more than my own. Like, any chance I get, I'd be in her kitchen while she was cooking. And I learned this later, but apparently Jimi Hendrix used to do the same thing. He used to play the broom like it was a guitar before he got a guitar. And I used to do the same with Edith's brooms. I'd sit on a little, like, step stool while she was making her, you know, soul food, cooking, after school, whenever, summer. And I would strum on that guitar, and I'd make up silly songs. I'd strum on the broom until the straws started falling out, the old school brooms. But my godmother was more, she entertained my, like, kind of craziness more than my mother did. You know, my mother was always supportive, but she wasn't the kind of one to be silly or play games. You know, she wasn't that outgoing. She was a bit more shy, more reserved, I should say. But Edith would kind of play characters with me and entertain that side of me, that creative side. And years went by when I was going to Edith's and making up my songs and whatever. And on my ninth birthday, Edith didn't show up that day. It was almost 10 o'clock at night, and I was really, really sad. And I kept saying to my mother, I haven't seen her all day. She never misses a birthday. I haven't got a card. There's nothing. I don't understand what happened. I was, like, you know, in my pajamas, and then the doorbell rings, and I peep down the stairs, and I see the head of the guitar case coming in the door.
Coming through the door before she did.
Yeah, coming through the door before her, and my heart, I remember just sort of sitting down on the stairs, like, just completely over. She was out all day trying to get that guitar. Like, she had made an arrangement with such, you know, this is an old black lady who has no idea how to buy a guitar. You know what I mean? It's like, it was not in her. So she had asked around and figured out how she would get it and who was going to bring it to her or whatever. And sure enough, she gave me that guitar. It was a K guitar, Paula guitar with the music note on it. It's a real classic old school guitar, the first guitar for kids. Kind of small, terrible action on it. You know, I think they're made in Japan or whatever.
Right.
I don't know. But it was my dream come true. That was just the best birthday of my life.
So when you got that guitar, did you start playing, well, you had to learn, obviously, some chords, but did you start playing other people's songs, stuff that you'd heard on the radio, or did you start writing your own song straight away?
That the only thing I could do was imitate, you know, almost like any baby sort of learning something. You just sort of hear it first and try and do it yourself. I started to try and learn all these guitar riffs and things that I heard, not so much chords, because I didn't know how to do that. I had no idea, but like little funky riffs, like the sort of guitar riff on You've Got the Love for Rufus and Chaka Khan, would have, like, even though that came a little later, but stuff like that had like lines to it, you know, single lines. And I also didn't know how to tune it. And I was scared to. I remember being afraid to turn the tuning pen to the top because I didn't want the strings to break. Where do I get string? You know, what happens? Am I going to break it? It was looking at this instrument in front of me, like this wonderful, like amazing thing that had just fallen from the sky. And like, what do I do? Like, it's magic.
And you're 9 as well. I mean.
Yeah. So I was really excited and I just spent hours with it. I have a photo somewhere of me with my older sister. And I think, she's holding the guitar and I'm trying to show her something on it. So I obviously was like, you know, I was making some progress and it was a great picture of her, of me kind of standing over her like I'm some, you know, music scholar. I am trying to get my big sister to figure out how to play.
Were you singing as well at that age?
I was. I wasn't aware that it was anything particularly special. It was fun to do. One of my older brothers had one of those reel-to-reel tape players, like that was on Mission Impossible, like those old school little tiny little tapes with a microphone. I don't know where he got it or why he had it, but he would let me record my voice, which was so exciting because then when it came back, it was like, it's like I'm on the radio, you know?
Yeah.
So the song, I would sing one song over and over again, which was Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Because it was like a hit at the time or something when he had it. I remember we had the 45, put it on that old console, and I was like, sitting on that, you know. That was my jam. I never sang in church or anything like that. In school, like kind of school assembly kind of stuff maybe. But I wasn't kind of interested in being in the choir. I didn't have that kind of a voice. I still don't.
So the bass came a couple of years later, and I believe you read an ad looking for a bass player. So you borrowed a bass and joined a band.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to work in school. I was 14 at that point. So I had been playing guitar from 9 to 14. I was getting a lot better on the guitar. So I thought I was good enough to maybe actually get somebody to pay me to play in a band. I had a band with some kids in my neighborhood across the street, but we would just play for fun in my mom's basement. So I went out looking for a band that was going to make money in the summer, like a top 40 band, because that's what you would see advertised. And there were all of the ads that I saw in this particular music store were guitar players' ads looking for bass players or maybe a keyboard player, if I recall. They seemed to be the rarest thing. Nobody was playing bass or keyboard, or at least they couldn't find anyone. And so I was really disappointed because nobody needed a guitar player. It was always people like me looking for a band, to make their own band. So I went, okay, I'm going to borrow a bass because it can't be hard. It's got to be easier than the guitar because I've learned it. Yeah, just two less strings, one note at a time.
Right.
Not have to worry about these bar chords and all that shit. So I borrowed my older sister's best friend. Boyfriend's bass. He had a Rickenbacker, I remember that. And I went to the audition with my sister's best friend, the one whose boyfriend owned the bass. And the funny thing was that the guy who opened the door thought that she was the bass player. And she was like this hot woman who had a Japanese mother and a black father. She was really sexy and 8'20" or whatever. And he was like the guy who ended up hiring me. He thought I was the kid's sister. I went in and I plugged in the bass and he was like, oh my God. How old are you? I was like, well, I'm 14. He was like, oh, I'm not sure. But I played and he was like, you're good. I can't deny it. You can have the job.
You were off and running with the bass. Now, before we sort of jump into your career, which really sort of got going a couple of years later. You mentioned earlier on in this conversation that film was something that you were interested in at the time. And I remember when I first met you, that we talked about film and it was something that you wanted to do. And I knew that you had actually gone to school briefly, right, at the California Institute of the Arts for film and video.
I did, yeah. I did 3 semesters there, and I loved film when I was a teenager as well. They kind of went hand in hand with music. I did a lot of screenwriting. I loved writing stories. I was always good in English. My math is shit, but I was good with words, but not numbers. Maybe that's why I can't read music. But I just, I was doing kind of making Super 8 films and writing screenplays and, you know, potential teleplays and stuff for TV shows and stuff just while I was in high school. And when I wanted to go to college, I felt like I didn't really want to go to music school because I thought I didn't have a basis for it yet. I couldn't get into a university when I really didn't know anything about reading music and stuff. So I thought I would rather study filmmaking, and I can write music to go with the movies. And I can, they, you know, to me, they kind of went together. I was inspired by a lot of soundtracks for films. And so, yeah, so I went to CalArts. But when I got there, I realized when I kind of got a taste of the reality of the movie industry, I knew that I didn't have the temperament for it. It would eat me alive. There's no way I could survive creatively in that world. So I decided to full-time go back to music. So I left CalArts.
You moved to London when you were 20, 22. What took you there?
After I left CalArts, I went to New York City for like a year. You know, I was making demos on a 4-track and meeting people, and it was a good time to be in New York. It's like 1983 or whatever. But I was not having much success with anybody kind of getting the music I was doing, because I think I've never really done like urban music. It was like I felt like I was facing the thing in Philly of like the racist thing or racism or whatever against, well, I'm Black, so my music should be R&B or identifiable as like a Black artist when you hear it. But it's never been that, because it's just not how I sound. Well, it's not what I do. So I had a lot of people just going like, well, yeah, they didn't kind of know. You know, I was trying to go around to record labels and managers and stuff. So I had an opportunity. A friend of mine from London was in at CalArts with me, and he also went to New York City at the same time. And he was in the design department, like the graphic artist department, but he was also a musician, like me, when he was younger. So we both had gave up our music and kind of went into the visual arts. And we started working together and writing some tunes together. He played keyboards. And he went back to London at one point. He's like, I got to go back to London. You know, it's not happening here. And, you know, I'm not a student anymore, and et cetera. So I said, well, take me with you. I've got nothing going on here in New York. I'm working in a record store. I love that. It was fun. But, you know, maybe I can take my demos to London and maybe they'll like them in London. And I, at that point, we were very close, and I knew his family very well. And they were like, yeah, come on over. Come stay with us. So I had one bass with me, one guitar, like 50 quid in my pocket, probably of that. But, you know, I think I was actually 20 at the time, or 21 at that time. You know, I had nothing to lose. You know, I was young. And so I went there and stayed with his family and started to meet people in London. And that was where it all happened, that I did not face that same kind of bias about, okay, if you're Black, you got to be in this market. Everybody was all over the place in London. It was like, it didn't matter what race you were. You could have been African, you could have been West Indian, you could have been French, you could have been whatever, American. If they liked the song, they liked the song. They never addressed those issues. I never found that anyway. Maybe other people might have felt that, but I never felt that. And to me, that was so liberating. I was like, wow. People kind of like what I'm doing because they like what I'm doing. They're not asking me, oh, well, it's not, we don't know what to do with it or whatever. It's like, oh, let's build on this. Let's make something happen. So London was a dream come true.
I remember when I first moved to the US in 1988, I was surprised to find how music was really sort of broken down into formats, which we didn't really have when I grew up in England. It was
exactly. It
was the top 40. It was the top 40, whatever songs were selling.
Precisely.
Whereas here you had, you know, the the urban chart, the country chart, the alternative chart, the folk chart, very much more sort of segregated, really, musically.
Completely, completely. And even when I finished my first album, The Corporate World, on Warner Brothers in the UK, and then it was picked up by Sire in the US, and I came over for a very small little kind of radio tour and kind of meet the people in LA and in New York and whatever. And it was just me and my guitarist. So it was just the two of us kind of doing little shows. Even then it was like, they were constantly talking about, well, we have to figure out, you know, they changed the cover of the album to maybe it would make people get a better idea what kind of music it was from looking at it on the shelf. I was like, how fucking ridiculous is that? You know, it could be any gun. It could have had a picture of a rose on the cover. I mean, you know, but anyway, that was still going on years later after I came back with a record that, you know, did fairly well in the UK. It was never a big hit, but it got a good response. It got great reviews.
Yeah, I got a 5-star review, voted one of the top 50 albums of the year by Q magazine, which was
that was huge.
Big deal.
Oh, yeah.
You did another album in 1991 for Island Records called Rude Blue. Tell us about that album, and then what precipitated you coming back to the U.S. around about the time that we met?
Yeah. Well, Rude Blue was like, it was unfortunate because I was so kind of had enough with the record label. Again, I wasn't able to, I guess, function as creatively as I wanted to within the record label thing. I always wanted a record deal, but then I had one and I was like, maybe I need to take a break. So I took some time off after I left Warner Brothers. They didn't drop me. I asked to go away. I asked to leave. And when I was kind of just working on some new songs for whatever purpose, maybe I would get another record deal, maybe I'd put it out myself, whatever. My manager at the time ran into Chris Blackwell from Island Records on vacation somewhere. I don't know where, if it was in Jamaica or wherever he was. And my manager said, you know what? I just ran into Chris Blackwell and I told him that you're not on Warner Brothers anymore. And when I first signed to Warner Brothers, he was one of the bidders. I had like three options. I had Island, I think I had Virgin, and I had Warner's, and I went with Warner's. And I probably should have went with Island the first time. But Chris was like, I've always wanted to sign her. Whatever she's working on, she can just come and do whatever she wants. So it was kind of that. I took up his offer. And I love Island Records because some of my idols were in there, especially first and foremost, Grace Jones. So I was very happy to work with Chris. But the timing was really shitty because just as he had offered me that, he was in the process of letting go of the label and selling it to Polydor or whatever. So he was kind of stepping down from his real throne. And he was great. He came to my sessions. He never interfered. He liked what I was doing. He always liked what I was doing. But then when the record was finished and it had to go to Polydor for its release and whatever else had to go along with their promotion and everything, everybody there hated it. And he basically didn't stand up for me because he kind of couldn't, I guess, because he wasn't really in charge anymore. And I became what they called one of Chris Blackwell's eclectic signings that we just don't know what to do with. So it was just a bad kind of timing. That's why I say maybe if I had worked with him in the beginning, it might have been a more fruitful kind of relationship than this kind of bureaucracy I went through at Warner Brothers in the end. So that album, they pressed about 3,000 copies maybe, and they put it out just to put it out. And then I was gone from the label. And at that point, I was like, I'm really sick of record labels at this point. You know, I should never even, you know, I was already sick of them with leaving Warner Brothers. So I really just thought I want to just play music now because I was still working with other artists here and there. There were little projects coming and going, and I love all kinds of music. So when I would get an opportunity to do some kind of weird little jazz thing or something that would stretch me in another direction, I'd be down to do it. You know, I was really excited to have that experience. So I was happy to just say, I'll just be a session player from now on. And if I want to write my songs, I will. And if I want to do my own shows, I will.
Timing, of course, is everything in life, not just record labels. But I can understand how you got lost in the shuffle there, effectively, yeah. Because he sold the label. They contractually, I guess, fulfilled their obligation by pressing some albums, and then that was it. Was it also time to come home?
Yeah, well, yeah, actually, it's true, because things were kind of drying up, but there, like, the 80s was such an abundant time. There was, like, you know, in music, there was just so much going on, so much money around for stuff, all these young bands getting signed for these big deals. You know, like, my first tour ever with the Thrashing Doves was a British band that was signed on A&M, and they were for, like, £1 million or something. You know, it was, like, there was just money, or it was the 80s. Yeah, coming back, there was, like, stuff was kind of not, even started, I think, I can't remember who became prime minister, like, there was a downturn going in terms of all the availability of money and all the sort of grants and like stuff was kind of drying up a little bit. And I was feeling that this was in the UK because that's where I was working from. And then I decided, well, maybe it's time to go back to New York and just see what it's like in the States, because I had actually started to work with Tears for Fears at that time, and Roland worked a lot in Los Angeles. So I was, you know, kind of like, oh, I'm going to Los Angeles. I've been in L.A. And, you know, I'd go back to L.A. and I was like, it's not so bad. There's stuff going on here. So I kind of got curious because a few little things were bringing me to the States as opposed to the other way around. Even Gang of Four, we toured in the States with Thrashing Doves. So I was like, okay, maybe it's time. So, and I had met the bass player, Sarah Lee, who we spoke about with the big Impala, the 72 Impala. I met her in London, actually. She was playing with the Indigo Girls at the time. Her and Jerry. On all that big period with them, with Galileo. So she was with them at that kind of real height of things that was happening. And they came through London. And one of my best friends in London at the time was Louise Goffin, who's the daughter of Carole King, who you probably know out there in LA.
I know Louise, yeah.
So Louise was my buddy, my London. We were in London at the same time during those same years in the 80s. Both of us, for some reason, had wound up there, and we met each other. Actually through Andy Gill from Gang of Four. It's all so...
all connected.
I know, isn't it? And so Louise knew Sarah from New York earlier in the days, because Sarah was kind of like you, an expat from UK who came over to the States when I was going the opposite direction. And so she said, oh, my friend, you've got to meet Sarah. She's another bass player. She's amazing. And she called me one night and said, hey, the Indigo Girls are playing at Town and Country. Do you want to go? And I said, yeah, I'll go. So that's where I met Sarah after that show backstage. And Jerry and all those guys, James Scarpantoni. And I asked her, what do you do? Where do you live? Like, what do you know? She's like, I'm in New York. I'm in Woodstock. And I was like, well, I wonder what that's like, you know, because I... to be in New York, but I didn't know if I wanted to go back to the city, like when I was 21 and I was in a shoebox or a sublet, and you know, it's kind of hard times, you know, living on potatoes and things. But so I came over to visit her, and then I was like, yeah, this is perfect proximity to New York City, a couple hours away, a huge community, people like yourself, all the cool radio station, and all these famous musicians like Jerry Murata and stuff that I'd heard of, and Tony Levin. I was like, oh my gosh, they're all living up here. So it was just seemed like the right place to land. And I lived with Sarah for a year, and then I moved to an apartment in Kingston.
Yeah, Woodstock, incredibly creative community up there. Of course, famous for the festival that never actually happened there, but that's a whole other story. But I remember when I first moved there, and all these people was in the woods, all these creative people like film directors and, as you said, musicians and playwrights and a great community to tap into. You mentioned working with Roland Orzabal of Tears for Fears when you first came back to the U.S. And I remember seeing you playing with Tears for Fears at the Chance, I think, in Poughkeepsie.
Right. Yeah.
A little earlier on, when I mentioned a whole laundry list of people you'd played with, one of those bands was the Matt Johnson's band, who I love. You played on the album Hanky Panky, which was a Hank Williams covers. But I also remember there being a photograph of you inside the artwork on the CD, and you were called Hollywood Dorsey.
Yeah, well, that was a period when I was doing a lot of filming. Like, I was always everywhere with a video camera. I have incredible archives of things. But also, the idea was that everybody, because it was kind of like this country, you know, Hank Williams has that reputation of, like, you know, the barroom country, like down home, whatever. Like, Matt was saying, everybody should have like a nickname, like, you know, like Gunslinger Joe or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. So I became Hollywood Dorsey because they were like, oh, well, you're the Hollywood queen. You're like always with a movie camera.
Yeah.
It's about like making movies. So that's kind of where we decided mine would be Hollywood Dorsey.
Back to Tears for Fears. When you were working with Roland, you got the call that changed your life, completely redirected your career. David Bowie was on the phone looking for Gail Ann Dorsey.
Yeah, crazy. Don't know how. Well, I mean, later I figured out why. Well, according to what he had told me, I don't know whether it's true or not. But I was working on, I had done the tour for Elemental. And then we went straight into the studio in L.A., actually, and recorded Raul and the Kings of Spain. It was right when the Northridge earthquake happened.
It'd been 93, I think.
It was around that time, yeah. And but the power, would we'd be in the middle of a take and the power would go down and they'd get it back up again. But anyway, I did that album and then I went back to the UK actually with Roland to work on another solo record for me. Because he had just had a big success with Olita Adams producing that record for her when she had done Woman in Chains. And, you know, he was kind of thinking maybe we could have we could do something for me, which was great because I think his songwriting is spectacular. And I really enjoy working with him. And so I was actually at his recording studio in Bath, England, Bath. And that's where the phone call came from Bowie. He traced me down. I think he called my management in New York, whatever. And then they were like, no, she's in England. And he didn't know exactly where he was calling, but he got the right number. And I'm in the middle of working on songs and I go to take the phone call. And at first I thought it was somebody playing a joke on me because I lived in England so long. I thought it was a friend of mine putting on a Bowie accent and just trying to, you know. And he was like, no. He probably gets that all the time. Because I learned after getting to know him that he calls people personally. He doesn't just get management to call himself. He'll call, if he wants to do something, he'll call you. So it was him. After a couple minutes, I realized it was him. And he just began to explain what he wanted. I just couldn't believe I had gotten the call. I was terrified because Bowie to me was one of those people that in my wildest dreams, I would never be good enough to be in that person's band. Bowie was one of them. Olivia Newton-John was another who was one of my all-time idols. And a band like Frank Zappa or something. Like to me, those were those kind of bands where it's like, you got to be really good to play for Zappa or Bowie or because each, you know, the music is just so incredible and it seems like there's magic going on there or something, you know? So I just didn't think I would ever be good enough. So, but I had to, you know, I'd be damned if I couldn't try. I had to try. I almost would say no, you know, I don't talk about this much. I don't know. You might want to put it in your show because it probably doesn't matter that much now. But when, like, for example, when John Deacon, the bass player of Queen, left Queen, when he decided he didn't want to play anymore, Roger Taylor called me for his replacement. Queen is my favorite band of all fucking time. They are the greatest band I have ever seen, will ever see, I think, and I still think they're the best rock band ever. Ever. Just those four guys, the original guys, did such incredible work that I don't think anybody has topped in my books. However, I said no because there was no way I could live up to that. I mean, John Deacon is an incredible bass player who gets very little play in the bass world of all these others who are so famous, Entwistle and the guy from Led Zeppelin, John Paul Jones, and, you know, there's so many iconic bass players in these certain bands. Very few speak about John Deacon. And to me, what he was doing on the bass, because I'm a Queen fan, I know exactly what was going on those records. There was no way I could play that. And I turned the job down. But for Bowie, I just thought, I have to try this. I might not be good enough, but I mean, you know. And even Roland said to me when I got off the phone, he said, what happened? What did he say? I said, well, he said, it's just going to be 6 weeks and I can get back to my album or whatever I'm doing. Because Bowie asked me, he was like, what are you? What are you doing? And I explained. And then Roland just said to me, it's Bowie. Of course you go. You got to go.
You have to.
You don't say no to that. You know,
yeah.
So I did. And sadly, I didn't get to go back and kind of finish what we were just starting with Roland. But, you know, we did get a couple of songs out of there that we wrote together that are on the I Used to Be album, actually.
You alluded at the beginning of this part of the conversation to, you said, I think you said, I don't know why he was looking for me or came after me, but he told me a little bit later. Do you mind sharing that with us?
Yeah, well, I was afraid to ask him probably for about 2 years or whatever. And then one day I remember sitting on a bus, tour bus or something with him, and I said, you could have had any bass player, I don't know, a single one that would have turned you down to come and do what I'm doing. Why did you call me? I said, I can't read music. I'm not a shredder. I can't do any of that stuff. And he said, he said, I was in London years ago watching telly in a hotel somewhere. He said, and you came on the telly and you were promoting probably Corporate World, because that's the only thing that I did a lot of TV stuff in the UK for. But this would have been 1989. And I'm talking to him about this in 96 or whatever. He said, you sang a song and you went on the couch and you talked to the host. I don't remember what show, I did many. And he said, you were very interesting. And he said, and I said to myself, when I'm doing the right project, I would love to work with this woman. She's very interesting. God knows what I said, what I did. But I also know that if he felt that, because in retrospect, because I've sort of watched his process a little bit over the years, it would have meant that he then went and did some research on me too. He wouldn't have just remembered that one moment and just thought, oh, let me call that person. He would have looked through probably most things I'd done, imagined how I was going to fit, what it would look like, what it would sound like, what I was capable of musically already. He would have known, because everything that I'd watched him do prior, during my time working with him, when he would kind of bring in a new person or introduce something that we would, a new kind of songs we would work on or whatever, it's because he'd really done research on it. Like he knew what that person could do, or like he was just so astute about that and how it would fit in the vision of what he had as the end product. And that to me is one of his greatest gifts, is the people that have worked with him all the years, even before I came, now looking back at it and also having played a lot of that music myself, I can see how he always knew who to put in to make his vision come true of what he wanted to hear musically. He even said to me one day, art is about the skill of something, of putting a band together, he said, or making something, is throwing a lot of things into the pot and stripping it away to reveal it, as opposed to putting it there piece by piece. So you bring people who bring, so that meant that our working process, how we worked on things, we were like kids in the playground. We could try stuff, we could play, he was always encouraging. He was never kind of like, you know, dictating, okay, this and you play that and I want it to sound like that. And some people are like that, and that's okay too, because I, you know, whatever serves the song, I'm good with it. I don't care how it has to be, you know, kind of presented. He validated everybody. You just felt validated as a musician. So he would often, you know, kind of really know what he didn't want, I guess I should say. But he would allow us to try a lot of things.
How cool that he clocked you and made a mental note.
Exactly.
And 7 or 8 years later, you got the call.
Because it was the right project. Like he said.
Right time.
When it's the thing, so he had in mind a vision for Outside and all that, and then I guess I passed the test, you know, because a lot of people changed throughout the years that I was in the band. You know, the drummers changed and guitar players came and went and, you know, stuff like that. We added Catherine Russell, different people came in. But it somehow I completed that vision for him, you know, visually and sonically for the first, you know, Outside tour with Nine Inch Nails. And then it just continued. And I continued to kind of grow in his world as well, with more prominence and stuff. He seemed to include me more and more.
So you went for 6 weeks and stayed,
yeah,
basically for the rest of his career, playing live?
Right, all the live up until we stopped after the reality tour. Was it 2004 or 3 or whatever? He had his heart problem. And then he kind of went off the road pretty much for good. I think he did a few appearances here and there. But then I didn't know what was going to happen with him. We would keep in touch through email occasionally and have a phone call once in a while, or I'd see him in the city for a lunch or something, or coffee. But I've never, no matter how long I've been with somebody, one thing I've always learned in this business, I have never, and I can say this seriously and honestly, I've never assumed that I'm coming back tomorrow, kind of thing, because it's just the nature of it. And it's not because I would have made a mistake or I'm not good enough or whatever. It's because artists change their mind, how they want to hear things, how different musicians they want to work with. I had David Gilmour call me to play, but I was working with Lenny and I couldn't do it, to do some shows in the summer. And when he calls out of the blue, again, another call that just came out of nowhere, he said, you know, I'm calling because I've played with the same people for a long, long time now. And I'm just doing these few dates in Europe in the summer. And I just want something new, just because. He said, I've lost, all my peers are dying, you know, Bowie, everybody's going away. I don't know how much longer I have, but I would like to just do something that I don't normally do, just for the hell of it. And so you have to realize that that can happen. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's not a personal thing. It's the choice of the artist is the way it should be, you know. And so I was never sure that I'd be back. And then I got called to play on the Next Day album, the one before the last, because I didn't do much playing on the albums, the little pieces here and there. Earthling was my first recording with him. We did a few kind of one-off things, like for some compilation albums together. And we made some recordings that have never been released. I wonder sometimes where those are with me.
Interesting. I wonder where they might show up at somewhere.
I don't know who owns all the rights to everything. We did. Right. We actually recorded me doing Oh Superman, because we used to do that in the
The Laurie Anderson song.
Anderson song. We did an actual, we went in the studio and did that. It was really cool. I actually have video of us doing that. But I don't know where that is. There's a few things that I did with him.
When you look back at that time and the concerts and the festivals, I know you feel gratitude and you feel blessed to have had that opportunity, but if you could sort of sum it up, how do you look back at that time?
I guess because of where I feel like just creatively and just in general the world is right now, let alone myself, I look back at that as I wish I had enjoyed it even more. I enjoyed a hell of a lot, but I think I wish I had, I don't know, it was just... It was magic. It almost seems like a dream. And the weird thing now is because there's so much of this stuff that you can see on the internet, you know, and a clip will come up and I'm like, oh my God, that will look at me. That was me. Like, I almost don't believe it was me now. It just seems so long ago. But I sort of think, gosh, you know, I wish I could have even relished it even more, you know, oddly enough.
It's hard to believe that David left us almost 9 years ago. January 2016, and I know his death hit you very hard. How were you able to absorb that loss personally and professionally?
It's still hard, you know, especially now, because there have been a bunch of tribute things in his honor, which as it should be, but there's been an awful lot of them that I don't really want much to do with. But I feel like there's also a lot of energy that came at me, because people identify me with him a lot. People saw like a connection there or something, you know? And so when he was gone, a lot of people reached out to me. Of course, to say they were sorry, but like a lot of people, when I have done some of the tributes and some of the things I'm still involved with, there's only a couple of things that I really like doing and I'm happy to do, but the rest of them I'm not interested. But, you know, people are just like, I'm like the next best thing or something. It's just that I think I get a feeling that people they've told me this. They're like, just to be able to see you, you know, makes us feel closer to him again, because whatever they witness, whatever we gave off as together on stage or whatever things we've done together, David and I, it made a really emotional impact on people. And I realized that a lot after his death, that, you know, a lot of people come to me with that sort of energy of feeling that they're happy to see me, you know, because it reminds them of that time.
I was looking at some footage before we got on the Zoom today of you performing with David, and then I was looking at one particular performance where you were doing Under Pressure, which sort of brings all of your musical loves together in one song.
That's like a miracle. It was early on that he asked me about doing that, and then it was always in the show, no matter what incarnation of the tour or whatever, we always did it. And for me, it got better and better. Like by the time the version, I think, on the reality tour is probably my best vocal performance of that. Like at that point, I really had the spirit of Freddie. I mean, every night when I sang it, I would look out at the lights and I would actually make a mental call out to Freddie Mercury to say, A, thank you. B, give me permission to do this. C, give me what I need to do this as best I can in representing him, because he was my favorite. I'd never seen a performer like him. And I was really, so it was always an emotional night. I never took it for granted. I never felt like, oh, it's another night of under pressure. I was like, every night I got to get better and better and better. I got to be as good as what, you know, thrilled me as a child, as a young person, seeing that band. So it was just a miracle. I mean, I don't know how these things happen, really. I must have some good karma somewhere. I like to think so. I like to think I've done something good somewhere for somebody. So I guess I'm getting, you know, because those sort of things are like, money can't buy that. Nothing can give you that. You know, those experiences that I've had on stage with him and several other people.
He continued recording and touring with artists in a lot of different genres as well. You are very much a multi-genre person, very eclectic in your musical tastes and who you play with, blues, soul, country, rock, funk. And you mentioned earlier on, you got a call from David Gilmour, but you were playing with Lenny Kravitz, who you worked with for a few years as well.
10 years. I just finished with him a good pandemic. I was planning on moving on from Lenny. We had a big tour that was planned in 2020 and 2021. Of course, it was canceled. And he's only just picked that up with this new record that just came out. So he's only just got a new band and started to go. But I was going to do that next tour with him and then kind of pack it in because I'm not getting any younger and I really want to make another record. And I haven't done one for almost 20 years at this point. And I had some songs bubbling and I feel like I have a few things I'd like to say again. You know, I have no delusion or whatever that I'm going to be the next whatever, you know, the next big thing. But I think that there's an audience for what I have to do and say, and I want to do it. So I knew that I had spent a lot of time working for a lot of other people, not regretting one day of it, enjoying every minute of it and being grateful for that. But it takes a lot of energy. And, you know, the older I get, you know, there's a little bit less energy to go around, just in life in general. So I was like, I'm going to do many and then I'm going to pack it in for that kind of thing. I'll do a session here and there or something that doesn't take me away for 6 months or 8 months or 12 months a year. You know, I can't do that and do my own thing at the same time. I've never been good at multitasking in that way. So, so Lenny, I finished with him. I ended up just not coming back, basically. So, but I did my last tour with him, I guess it was 2018. Into 2019.
We're going to get to the music questions in just a moment, but before we do, most recently you were living in Paris.
And
I know you were working with the French guitarist and band leader, Mathieu, how do you say his last name?
Chadid.
You did a play with Audrey Tautou while you were there as well.
Yeah.
Tell us about that time in Paris and where you're at in the process of maybe making another record of your own.
Yeah, I went to Paris. I had a partner at the time. Sadly, it didn't work out so well, but I kind of needed to get to Paris because the borders were all closing down. And it was like, if I didn't get there, I wouldn't see my partner. So I managed to get to Paris. You know, I had whatever paperwork and stuff you had to have. And I needed, at that time, I was doing a Patreon to make some money, a Patreon subscriber thing, mm-hmm. which I'm going to be starting up again probably next month or certainly by February. But I I needed a place to do my Patreon stuff. Like I'm talking to you now from my little home studio. So I have like a setup where I can do pretty much everything I need to do in here except drums and a real piano. But I needed a space where I could set up my laptop and do music and the things that I was providing on Patreon, which had a lot of, to do with streaming and stuff. We were living in a little small apartment, so I needed a place. I asked a good friend of mine, who's a big promoter that I've known since Corporate World days, you know, if he knew of anybody who had a little room or something I could rent, or I just need a table, I'd bring my speakers. I had everything kind of compact. And then 24 hours later, my friend calls me back and he says, I think I found you a studio in Paris. I said, well, you know, I'm not making much money. I can't afford. He's like, no, everybody's on lockdown. And this person is somebody who's a big fan of yours. And he was kind of laughing. And I said, well, he said, yeah, he's offered you the keys to his studio in Paris, just off the Jardin de Luxembourg. It's like, you know, it's like in a great area and it has its own little garden in the back. I was like, what? Who? What? And it was Matthew Shadi. I knew of him, but from back in the 90s, I bought his second album in like 1997 when I was in Paris. And often when I would go to Paris or Berlin or somewhere, I would ask, what's the new thing that's hot? I want to hear what's going on. And his album at that time was, and I bought it. And I was like, I don't speak French that well. I'm much better now than I used to be, but it is my favorite language outside of English. So I listened to it and I was like, oh, this is really cool. You know, but then I never heard of him again. I never thought about him again. But since that time, he had become like the biggest artist in France. I mean, he's hugely famous. And between 2022 and 2023, or 21, 22, I can't get so confused in those COVID years. We did 150 shows in 1 year in Paris, in France alone.
Wow.
Outside of 4 shows in the Reunion Island, which is an island off of Madagascar, down by Africa. And then we did like a show in Quebec City and Montreal, and then the very last show was in London at the Kentish Town, which used to be, is called something else now. Because he only speaks French, I can communicate with him kind of, but his English is really, really bad. So we only played anywhere that French people, you know, French speaking people. But in France, he's so big that we could do like 150 shows in that country alone in 1 year. And it was like the first shows were 13 nights at the Folie Bergère. 13 nights, sold out, packed to the actors. Every French movie star and actor and my buddy Agnès B, the clothes designer who did all my stuff for Bowie. Agnès did all of our clothes for that tour, his included. She did amazing clothes. So I just ended up working with him because I was in his little home studio in Paris, and he had an amazing studio in his home, in his country home, where he was in lockdown, like about an hour outside of Paris. And he invited me over for lunch, and I had a little jam with him one day when I finally met him. I was in this amazing little home studio for like almost a couple of months before I even met the guy. Just to trust, to give, you know, the keys and everything. It was so great. And then we just became really good friends, and he was a great artist, a great guy, amazing guitar player, great producer. I mean, he's just huge. He's all over things, and he does movie soundtracks and all kinds of things. He's won awards. So Matthew and I had a really good time, and I am invited. Well, I'm not going, but I'm invited for the next tour next year, but I just can't do another 8 months away because I'm working on my own stuff now. Matthew was the last sort of big thing.
So where are you at with your own stuff?
This year has been really challenging a little because I'm learning the business again, Nick. It's crazy. I don't know how things were, the streaming and the one song at a time and this and that and things like this, podcasts, and just getting all. So I'm kind of doing the groundwork. Most of this year has been just trying to kind of set the plan. Musically, I've had a few songs that were already in the works that I've just finished up. So I don't have the whole album done yet. I'm still writing, but I have enough things to start releasing. And so we're just getting to that point now. I just got a great logo made up from a designer in the city, and I'm going to start doing some merch. I've got a photo shoot in a couple of weeks. I haven't had one of those for a long time to get some, you know, images together. And we're going to release something probably next month, if not February at the latest. Just one thing at a time. I have some, because I've got some mixes, some new mixes being done. Actually, a guy out in LA is mixing something for me now.
I should point out that we're talking in early December of 2024. So for people listening to this, we're talking about January, February of 2025.
It's all a work in progress now. You know, I'm just sort of trying to kind of get my sea legs, as they say. Like, I don't really, it's all so foreign a little bit. It's not like we're just going to work. It's a lot more work in a different kind of brain capacity.
I'm looking forward to hearing whatever you're going to put out next. I think the last time we did anything professionally was when your last album came out in what,
2004.
And I remember coming to Woodstock and doing a live show back to LA with you. You performed on my old KCRW show.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got, you know, trying to get the guitar chops going. I have to say, it's been a bitch.
Let me ask you a question. Is it easier to play regular guitar and sing, or play bass and sing?
It's easier to play guitar and sing, especially if you're just playing chords.
Right.
But I am doing bass and voice, and I'm working harder on that because I want that to be more of a thing, because it's more interesting. How many people get up with a guitar and sing? It's like a typical singer-songwriter thing, which is fine because there's some great people who do it. And I like it too, but I have to say, I haven't really played guitar like that for so long now. I've really been in my bass mode, that when I pick up the bass, it's like a relief. I said, oh, God, I can play this. It's comfortable, but can I sing a whole song and play bass with it? So I've started using some loops, very simple, and trying to create, you know, I open my show now with some... singing just a bass voice version of Stevie Wonder's Visions and song on Inner Visions, After Higher Ground. There's that little do-do-do-do-do. It's kind of a... So that's something I can kind of play that on the bass, and you can still hear the whole song. And the melody is just so brilliant. So I kind of do stuff like that.
Before we jump into the music questions, I got one more bass question. You mentioned John Deacon, and we were talking about some of the great rock bass players. If I had to pin you down and ask you who the most influential bass player has been on your career, who would that be?
It would be somebody that's not from the rock world at all. It's Joe Osborne. Joe Osborne was a part of the Wrecking Crew. He played on Partridge Family, Streisand, America, Carpenters, like a bunch of that kind of early 70s popular music. I don't know what you'd call that. I just love that kind of playing. I love those kind of songs, I think. And basically, the person who would be more contemporary, who's my second favorite, is Leland Sklar, who you probably know, Lee Sklar with the beard, you know. Mm-hmm. They're kind of in the same league. It's just that Joe Osborne was before him, a little bit before him, a little older. But the same, that melodic kind of play where you hear a bass line, a bass part, and it's not just, it can be anything, but when the bass has the space to be melodic within the tune is the most exciting thing for me. And you have to be careful with the bass. I don't do lessons, but sometimes I do bass seminars and people ask me questions about, you know, approach. It's like the bass is the leader of everything. It's the hands on the wheel that turn the car left or right and move it in the direction that it's going to go. And if it wants to go left, the whole thing is going left. And so you have a huge responsibility on the bass. And players like Joe Osborne and Lee Scalar, and many others too, or even Tony Levin as well, he has that same sensibility, Pino Palladino, where it's like, the bass does like, it's like another voice. It can do a dance within the thing. It doesn't have to hold the rhythm like people imagine the bass and drums. Well, yeah, the bass and drums is a given in a way, but there's also more movement that can happen with the bass. And the players who play like really nice little lines and riffs and beautiful tones and up the neck and throughout the song, that's what I like doing. That's what I try and learn to do, is to be able to have more expression on the instrument and not get in the way, because it takes up a lot of space, the bass. People don't think it does. They often say, I can't hear the bass. It's low. It's in the, you know, I'm like, if it's gone, you will know it's not there. That way, you can always hear it if it's there. Even if it's the left hand on the piano or something, it doesn't matter. Whatever plays that part is kind of driving the direction of a piece of music or a song.
Let's get to the musical questionnaire. What is your first musical memory?
Probably is hearing the guitar solo from Jimi Hendrix on, like, I don't remember which one it would be. It's probably Foxy Lady. Like, just hearing a guitar solo like that was just like, that I have to play the guitar. I got like that, wow, like it just spoke to me, which was why guitar is my first instrument. It's still my first love in terms of an instrument. So I think hearing guitar solo not only Jimi Hendrix, from Terry Kath of Chicago Transit Authority. The guitar solos on most of those early records, especially the first one with I'm a Man and all that, before Terry Kath shot himself by accident. That was my first memory of like how explosive music could be. It just tore me apart. I would listen to those solos and they would just be like voices talking to me, just like ripping through my very being. I was like, I got to be able to speak this language.
where were you hearing that music as a child?
From the radio and my siblings. They had the records. They had Hendrix, all the early Hendrix records. They had Rare Earth. They had a band called Cold Blood that was amazing. All the Chicago Transit Authority, Earth, Wind, and Fire. That was the beauty. Like, my siblings' record collection was a mixture of stuff. It wasn't just R&B. It was, yeah, we had Otis Redding, but we also had, you know, Cream, you know, because it was funky. Zeppelin was in there. They were all in there. And it wasn't abnormal to sort of listen to all of these things. I think something you said earlier, I know we were getting off topic a bit, but when you said earlier about how you came and everything was kind of compartmentalized with music on the charts and everything here, that was different. I think it became that, certainly by the time you got here. Because I listened to something on Radio Kingston the other day. It was a playlist of what was the top 15 songs in 1971 on March 3rd or something like that. And they just played them. It was all over the place. There was a country song. There was John Denver on there. Then it went into Donny Osmond. And then after that was Marvin Gaye. And then it was some country tune that I'd never heard of. And then there was Gordon Lightfoot. It was like, the list was unbelievable. But that changed somewhere along the line. Anyway, we can get back to your other question. Sorry.
That's okay. No, I mean, it's fascinating, really, to, you know, when you think of the history of how people heard music, how people discovered music, whether it was a sibling's record collection or the radio or TV shows. I mean, growing up in England, it was radio, but it was also television with shows like the Old Grey Whistle Test and so many different places you would hear music. What was the first music you bought with your own money?
You know what? I didn't know that your thing was just audio only. So just in case it wasn't, this was the first album I bought.
Slade.
This isn't the original one. Because I remember I lost it and I bought like another copy somewhere in the UK because I didn't have that stick. This, and it's because of what you just said about all the different things on TV. We had what was called the Midnight Special, I think it was.
Yeah.
And there was one before that. I can't remember whether it might be. And they were always on those TV shows, Slade. And they had a song that I just loved for some reason. And I was like, I love that when Slade comes on. And they play that song, and they have the, they were all like glam. They were like Bowie. They had the Stack Hill boots. It was the glam thing. That was the first time I went to the record store, and I said, I want to get that record that I keep hearing on the Midnight Special, and it's freaking Slave. And this album is killer. I think the song that they used to play on there was, what was the song that they were playing? It might have been Goodbye to Jane.
I remember that one.
How Do You Ride? Naughty Holder. I didn't know who they were or where they were from.
I love that your first purchase was Slade. It was not my first purchase, but I will tell you that one of the early albums that I bought myself, I had a couple of albums that were bought when I was a kid, like my mom bought me Help, the Beatles, obviously, and then my mom and I split the purchase price of Sgt. Pepper's.
Oh, wonderful.
Which when it came out in 1967 was 30 shillings. And I think I had 15 shillings in my piggy bank, and my mom split the record with me. But one of the first records I bought myself was a Deep Purple record, and I ended up trading it for Slade Alive, their live album. And they were from Wolverhampton, which is not that far from where I come from in Birmingham. We're doing this on Zoom, and she just showed me the cover of Slade, S-L-A-Y-E-D, which was their third album, and Dave Hill with his shirt off, and yeah, that's great stuff.
Yeah, I love that. The one that I didn't buy but was my first album that was given to me, like you were saying with your mom, was this one, Partridge Family album, which is by one of my favorite records of all time. And this has Joe Osborne on it. This is the original Partridge Family, the first album that came out from the TV show. It would have been
that signed?
Only by the Prince.
Oh, okay. I thought it was.
No, I wish.
Yeah.
But this was given to me by my brother.
Love it.
I coveted this record. I love David Cassidy.
What about live music? What was the first concert you went to?
I have that too.
Isaac Hayes.
Black Moses. I went with my siblings, my brother who had the tape recorder.
How old were you?
My sister took me. I think I would have been about, what year is this? 9, 10? Oh, boy. Let's see if it's written once.
So that came out in 71.
71, that's right. So I was 9. I was right.
Do you remember how it made you feel? Do you remember how you felt?
So excited. We went to the Spectrum, which is no longer there. I went to the very last show they had there with Todd Rundgren. It was so sad. But that's where I saw all my big concerts as a kid, Philadelphia Spectrum. And I was just excited. I was so excited. I don't know. I just, you know, and everybody was smoking weed and stuff. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm like grown up. I'm 9. And oh, and the music. I was just, it was mesmerizing. I can still visualize that like, we weren't in the greatest seats. We were up on the side, I remember. But just looking down at that stage for the first time and seeing the lights. And then they came out and Isaac Hayes started playing. And I was like, oh my God, there it is. It happened in real time. It's like, it was so exciting. I think I was standing up the whole time.
What do you listen to when you want to dance?
Disco, any disco. I love, in fact, I just DJed a disco set at the Unicorn Bar in Kingston on Saturday night.
Oh, wow.
I love disco. And that's Donna Summer. It's any of it. Lou Rawls, Donna Summer, MFSB, Sister Sledge, Chic. Some of the lesser, you know, Vicky Sue Robinson, all of that, any of that stuff. If I want to dance, I just put on, like, Rumor Has It, Donna Summer. You know, that just, like, come on.
Can't beat that.
Because you can't, well, the beauty of real disco, because that was my point. I was like, you're not going to hear anything tonight that was recorded after 1979. So whatever disco people call disco sometimes these days. I went all the way to Manhattan for a disco party thinking I was going to get that. I was so excited. I wanted to have a dance. This was like recently. And that's what made me do it. I was pissed off. I went down there and the kid who was spinning the records couldn't even have been born when disco happened. And he's playing like this electronic music with these kind of samples of like Fleetwood Mac or something on the top, like something, you know, like a mix of something that's old on top of some electronic beat. And I was like, some fucking disco. So I left and I was pissed. I was like, I'm going to make a disco list, you know, playlist and show people what's really disco. We're going Studio 54 straight up, you know.
What do you classify as the classic disco years? What, 73, 79?
Later, yeah. It was really, I think, at its peak in '70s, between '77 and '80, actually.
Right.
You know, Blondie even kind of came in on '80, like Call Me. Well, Call Me wasn't disco, but that was more punk. But like Rapture, but that was more '80s. But yeah, no, the '80, there was a few things. Tim Curry, when he did that great Fearless record, he had a bunch of disco tracks on there. It was so, I love that. I love that it was played. You know, I said to the DJ in New York, I said, can you really play a disco song for me? And he was like, well, yeah, what do you mean? What do you have in mind? And I said, something that has a real drummer on it. If it doesn't have real drums on it, it's not disco. Like a real, like there was a guy sitting there for 15 minutes, you know, doing four on the floor, the hi-hat, you know, making the groove like you wouldn't believe, you know, like a machine would never be able to do. And that was the irony when I had people coming up to me at the club say, this is the best dance mix I've ever heard. I was like, young people. And I was like, well, it's real disco. That's my thing. It's not techno or whatever, electro or whatever they call it. But not that I'm a snob. I like some electro.
Sure. But, you know, if you want to hear disco,
If I want to dance, I want to hear Donna Summer straight up.
If you could only hear one song for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
That was a hard question. My answer would have to be Joni Mitchell, Both Sides Now, from the album of the Orchestrations. This is from 2000, when she did an album with a lot of her own songs and a couple of jazz standards. And the album was called Both Sides Now. And her version of Both Sides Now at the end of this album is stellar.
There's a version of A Case of You on that is just stunning.
It was between those two, but I was like, if I can only listen to one song for the rest of my life, it would be Both Sides Now.
I'm all of a sudden remembering going to see Joni Mitchell in Los Angeles doing what was kind of like an unplugged thing for VH1. I don't know whatever happened to it. And I went with you.
That's right. In 96, I didn't know that. That was the last time I saw her live. There were her paintings were around. I was in town. You were there. I remember.
Yeah, I remember it was with you and my ex, Abba. It went on for a long time because unfortunately it was a taping and she was smoking in between songs. And then it took her a minute to get her voice back. I actually ended up interviewing Joni a few years later. And it's a very cherished moment.
Oh, hell yeah.
But good choice. Do you have a favorite music video?
Bohemian Rhapsody, Queen.
Say no more.
Do you
have a recent musical discovery that you'd like to share with our listeners? It doesn't necessarily have to be a new band, but something that's new to your ears.
Just this year, I've started to hear on the local radio station a band called Salt.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know who they are because they're kind of like, they don't say who's in the actual band. S-A-U-L-T, they're from the UK.
Yeah.
I love their shit. They're really innovative and creative, and some of the song topics are really interesting, and there's humor in it and there's real darkness in it, but there's also beautiful kind of like creative stuff they're doing musically. I love whoever they are. I love them.
It's a collective. I think sort of, you know, there's a core group and then people sort of move in and out.
Exactly it. Well, that's something I discovered this year that I love. It's not easy to a record's like hard copy either. I had to order something on eBay to get one album that had a song I liked.
Is there a band or an artist that you love, but you feel that they perhaps never quite got the big break they deserved?
Jane Sibrey.
Love Jane Sibrey. And you've played with her, obviously.
I have played with her. I just saw her last Monday at Joe's Pub. I hadn't seen her in years. She was just as brilliant as ever. I just think she's on that level of people like Bowie in terms of a creative force, an artist who lives that life 24/7, you know, every day of their life is kind of who they really are, like who they're artists, you know, like, and her music is so profound to me and so incredible. And I, in some ways, I'm not surprised. Maybe she's not a big giant star, you know, she's not, because it's not that kind of thing. But I really think more people should know who she is and be connected to her music and her whole creative thing, because I find her outstanding. The words can't even describe how I feel when I listen to her music. And I think she is not well known enough. She's Canadian, by the way.
somebody else that we know, a mutual friend from Woodstock, David Torn, the guitar player, was working with her, and he introduced me to her music probably 30 years ago. And she had a moment there where she really was almost...
Almost.
Right? That didn't quite happen.
Yeah, but I think she had like a kind of similar feeling with the record label. I think when I met her in around the time that record, When I Was a Boy, it had like Calling All Angels and Love Is Everything, the duet. And Calling All Angels is a duet with K.D. Lang. Brian Eno produced that record, that one that was kind of almost there, the one that had stuff that people, you know. But I remember her saying to me, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly how she explained it, but she was like, that whole thing of producer and record label and stuff was just not her scene. It was too restrictive for her creatively. And I so respect that because I'm nowhere near the sort of genius of Jane Siberry, but I feel like I understand that experience because I felt it in my own small little way my experience with record labels. So I'm not surprised she's not a big giant star because she doesn't have that machinery behind her because she didn't want it.
We could send our listeners to wherever you listen to music to go check out Jane Siberry's music. The album that I loved, the one that I was when I first became aware of her, was Bound by the Beauty.
Absolutely, with the valley on it. Oh, what a song. Oh,
fabulous.
My goodness.
Yeah.
No, that's who I would say should be way at the top of people's listening lists.
Do you have a musical guilty pleasure?
The Carpenters, I guess you'd say. I was just listening to them in my car yesterday.
They're one of my guilty pleasures as well. I love the Carpenters.
They're fantastic. Yeah. Kevin's voice is just, I mean, come on.
Yeah, and there's that early 70s, early mid 70s pop sound that you were talking about as well.
That's
that you
right.
Love so much.
That's right. That has my favorite bass player on it, a lot of that stuff. And her drumming was just so damn cool.
We got one question left, but before we get to the last question, I'm going to ask you one that I should have asked earlier on in this conversation. It's been a fabulous conversation, by the way. First of all, because we're friends. We haven't seen each other for a long time, but I consider you a friend. And
absolutely.
I asked you if you had to name a bass player who had the most influence on you, and you named a couple. What about vocalists? What about singers?
Well, Karen Carpenter would be one. And like you can't see all my pictures here. Some of them are back there. There's Whitney. There's Jane Siberry behind me.
I see it. Yeah. I wish we had done this as a video podcast. Yeah.
I would say of all the ones, it would be, it's tough. It's a toss up between like Marilyn McCoo from the Fifth Dimension. Huge influence on me. I love the way she sings. I used to try and imitate all those records. Like I would sing them over and over and over again. That is a beautiful way of delivering a song. And then it would be Roberta Flack, I think. Big influence. Love Roberta Flack.
And our final question.
Yes.
How are you feeling right now?
Right this very minute?
Yeah.
Actually quite happy. I haven't been very happy lately because I've been so busy and tired. But right now, thinking about all the things that we've just discussed, I feel really happy right now. I feel like, okay, things aren't so bad. I had some good times. I'm trying, you know, I have all of these memories now because you've kind of, you know, stirred the pot a little bit. So I feel good, Nick. That's great. Thank you. That's very nice.
It's great to talk to you. And I'm excited to hear what you're going to do next.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I have to say the stuff I'm doing is very much like a lot of the music I've talked about today. It's very Carpenter-esque. It's very 70s. It's like what I think of the 70s singer-songwriter, which is a different kind of singer-songwriter than the 80s or the 90s or the 2000s, you know, it's like Jewel or whatever. It's different. And I'm kind of in that path. I have string arrangements when I can get them, you know, when I can afford them and get them happening. It's all very melodic based. It's old school songs, you know, not too much, you know, modern-ish stuff. But I'm not retro in a way either. I don't want to be completely, you know, I'm not trying to be Karen Carpenter, but I'm writing in a way that I'm honoring that music that I really, really love, which is, you know, gives you a lot of space to do a lot of things, really.
Can't wait to hear it. Gail Ann Dorsey has been our guest. Man, so cool to catch up with you. Thanks for doing the podcast.
You're welcome, Nick. I appreciate it.
The Sound of Success is hosted and produced by me, Nick Harcourt, for Nude and Ginger Productions. Our theme music is by Keita Klein. For more episodes, find us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, and thanks for listening.